Hi, this is Aaron Newcomb, and on this episode of Floss Weekly, I'm going to be joined by Simon Phipps. We're going to be talking to the developers of Baserock, a build system for embedded Linux solutions. It should be a lot of fun, and it's coming up right now on Floss Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Aaron Newcomb and Simon Phipps, episode 230, recorded on October 24th, 2012. Baserock. Welcome to Floss Weekly. I'm not Randall Schwartz, as you can tell. I am Aaron Newcomb, filling in for Randall. Randall's on a cruise and enjoying himself, I'm sure, at the bar. And we are filling in for him, and I'm joined today by Simon Phipps. Simon, thanks for joining.
It's my pleasure. I'm here in Southampton in the UK, nowhere near where Randall is sunning himself at the moment. If you've been following Randall on Google Plus or anywhere else, you'll see Randall has actually been losing weight while he's been on this cruise. So we can expect a slimmed down Randall Schwartz when he comes back.
That's right. And that's hard to do when you're traveling. It's awfully hard, even on a low-carb diet like he's been doing. I've done that in the past as a diabetic, and it's it can be hard when you're out and about because there's not always choices for you, or it's harder to find them anyway when you're traveling. So we wish him good luck on that. Well, we're not here really to talk about Randall. We're here to talk about open-source software. And today we've got an interesting project on tap called Baserock, which is a build system for embedded Linux projects or embedded Linux systems. So we're going to be bringing on these guys in a minute. And I'm not really as familiar with Baserock. I really hadn't heard of it until I was getting ready for this show. Simon, have you dealt with Baserock, or do you know these folks at all?
Yeah, I've run into Rob, who we'll be speaking to in the UK open source scene, and I'm actually quite excited by something that they've told me about. They've got a honking great ARM server that they are able to populate using this software, so I want to find out all about that from them.
Yeah, excellent. I thought this was all going to be about software, but I'm a hardware guy. I'm all for hardware, so that'll be quite interesting. Okay, well, let's not wait too long. Let's actually get these guys on, and we will talk to them. We're going to be bringing on two folks today: Rob Taylor, who is the CTO and founder of CodeThink. So we'll ask him about that. What's the relationship there between CodeThink and Baserock? And then Lars. Verzenus. I don't know if I'm saying that right. I apologize in advance, but we'll be bringing on Rob and Lars. So let's not wait. Let's go ahead and bring them on right now. Rob and Lars, are you there?
Hi. Yes, we are.
Great. And where are you guys calling or speaking to us from, I should say?
So we're speaking to you today from Manchester, the lovely, glorious, sunny day. Nice to be here.
Great. So you guys are based there. We should say that you guys work for CodeThink.
Yes, I'm actually the founder of CodeThink Limited, and Lars is one of our key architects and engineers.
Okay, great. So today we're going to be talking about Baserock. So just for those, why don't you give us kind of like the 30,000 foot overview? What is Baserock?
30,000-foot overview. Over the years, we've spent a lot of time working in embedded systems with Linux, and we've pretty much worked with every way there is to build an embedded Linux system, and every one of them is painful in one way or another. And Baserock is our attempt to make building embedded systems with Linux easy, straightforward, and reproducible and reliable.
And is this something that you guys use on a daily basis, or is it, a lot of open source projects obviously are scratch your own itch kind of thing. So is this similar?
This is something we use as part of our business, and we're starting to now that it's ready for use. And it's also a basis of a product in which we're selling as well.
Okay. Why embedded Linux? Maybe we should give just a little bit of a primer first for folks that haven't done embedded Linux or haven't worked with embedded Linux. I mean, why embedded? What is embedded Linux, first of all? Let's start with that. Let's get the high-level stuff out of the way.
Yeah. Embedded Linux is... So embedded systems are systems which aren't computers but have computers in them. An example would be a phone, though phones are now getting more and more like a computer. But they're all over the place. You know, your router is an embedded system. Your television is an embedded system.
Your car.
Well, your car contains many embedded systems. And more and more... certainly, it's been a case over the last 10 to 15 years that a lot of embedded systems are built using Linux. And now that is really the de facto standard for building new embedded systems. You're pretty much going to build them on Linux.
So just to simplify a little bit even further, so an embedded system mm-hmm. would be a system unlike a computer, which has software which is more dynamic. And things that an embedded system actually boots and runs a set of software that's static, right? That it's loaded on the system and doesn't. I wouldn't say it doesn't change, but doesn't change in the same way that a dynamic open system would.
That's the boundaries now. It used to be the case, so that was the case, but now the boundaries are a lot more blurred. I mean, you know, in a few years' time, you'll be seeing, you know, screens, or you already start seeing screens in cars, and in a few years' time, those screens will be running applications you could download off an app store. So, you know, where do you draw the line? It's certainly the case that embedded systems usually have some specific functionality to do with the task that they're handling, whereas computers... as we know today, are generalists. You know, your laptop that sits on your desk is a general-purpose computing device.
An embedded system also usually drives some kind of hardware,
yeah,
like an entertainment system or the control electronics for a car.
Right, as opposed to a big database or some other software application.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. So let's get into the name BaseRock. Why did you guys choose BaseRock? Is that bedrock, like the foundation of a system, or what's in the name?
Absolutely. I mean, the first kiss on the name was actually bedrock. You know, it's something that is the core of a system that's a solid foundation for you to build on, because this is the thing that we observed as being, you know, quite missing in our industry.
And talk a little bit more about that. I mean, I know that there are other systems out there, right, for doing embedded Linux. What's the need that's out there? What don't they do that you guys saw and you said, you know what, we really need to build this and make it happen?
So there's probably three major approaches to building embedded systems with Linux. One is you hand roll it all yourself. Basically, this is like following Linux from scratch. And there's tools to help you with that. There's one called Buildroot, which is very much in that field. Then you've got Open Embedded and Yocto, and they have an approach which is kind of like a packaging cross-compile approach. And the main problem, and that's for a long time, that was really best of breed. One of the main problems with that is that there's a lot of fragility in how it works. It's quite easy to mess yourself up. And it's also very hard to tell what you did that caused it to break. The other approach is to start basing off a desktop distro such as Ubuntu or Debian or Fedora, and strip it down for your embedded system. And the problem with that is that quite often a desktop distro is integrated in such a way to be useful for the desktop. As soon as you start trying to use it in a specific embedded computing environment, you're going to have to start changing things, and those changes can be throughout the whole system. You can be changing maybe hundreds of packages just to fit them together to work for your particular use case. And so one of the things that we try to do in BaseRock is that all of these systems don't really have a place where you say, and you fit these components together like this to do the job. You know, in all of them, they're kind of spread out over hundreds to thousands of packaging files. And so that's one of the first things that we started thinking though is, okay, the big task you do when you're building a system is integration. It's putting things together and making them work within a certain context. So can we have some, will we just, you know, one place where we write that down? And that was kind of one of the early thoughts in BaseRock. And once we had that kind of initial step, then we thought about what are the other things that go wrong when we're working in these systems, and how can we solve them? One of the main things that is a really common problem is a tester comes back, they're running an image. And, you know, if you've done things well, then you've probably given that image a good solid version number, so you know what built, you know, what you might, you process, and you probably know what packages, what versions of packages went on. But you're probably not entirely certain exactly which, what checkpoints in your source code repository went in. You're probably not certain exactly which packages changes you had gone into that build. You basically, you end up with this uncertainty of how you reproduce that case that this particular image that test has gone, hang on, there's a problem with this. So what we wanted to be able to do was be able to tie back, okay, here's an image, and we'll be able to tie that back down to the exact Git commit of every single piece of software that went into building that that particular image. So that gives us then this kind of trackability throughout the whole of the development process. Which gives you a level of control. It means that when you change something, you can go back and look and see that's exactly what changed, and that's what went wrong. Okay, so we've got that. What else would be really useful to have? It would be really useful if we had some sort of way of continuously testing our embedded systems, so that when we have made a change and it does break something will tell us that it got broken. So we integrate it. So because we have that trackability, that's quite easy then to build in. And then the one big thing that's left, that's always been a pain building based systems, is how long it takes to build them. I mean, all these systems, it takes, you know. I mean, if you're building it out of Ubuntu, it's probably not too bad. You know, you assemble your PPA, and an image build takes quite a chunk of time, you know, if you're using an image creator. But if you were going to start, if you're going to, like, make sure you had a clean build of everything that went into it, it would take days. Yocto, again, you know, if you want to do a clean build, it will take days to build your system, or... even if you're doing an incremental build, even just doing a single change and testing it, that can take you hours. And what we wanted to do was really make embedded systems development a lot more like, you know, hacking on a Python project or hacking on a Ruby project, where, you know, you can, it's quick to make a change and get that change out onto the hardware, test it and commit and push it up to GitHub and, you know, and a continual integration system tells you whether it's working. So basically, we wanted to making embedded systems such as the sort of things you make with Raspberry Pi or any of the commercial development boards as easy as hacking on, you know, a web project.
So just out of interest, Rob, you know, to make it more concrete for our viewers, what sort of devices are you targeting with these builds that you're making?
That's kind of a difficult question because there are a wide variety of devices that are embedded Linux systems. One of the main areas that we are working, that commercially CodeThink is working with, is the automotive sector. So we are working with things which go into cars. We've been engaged with this with a group called Genevi, which have the aim of making open sourcing cars a possibility. So that's one area that's really interesting and very much growth. But there's the possibilities of areas you can use this in are really quite endless. Like I say, televisions are there. And the way I see it, with things like Raspberry Pi around now, we can't even tell now what somebody's going to invent next year or the year after that. We've really democratized the ability to build embedded systems with things like Raspberry Pi, and we want to be helping support that you know, support that developer environment so people do make new things and make them faster and bring them out and get them to market get their open source projects out there.
Right. Now, I noticed from your website that you seem to be branching out into hardware as well. You seem to have a device that's called BassRock as well. Do you want to tell us about that? It looks very exciting. It looks like it's an 8-core racking slab by the look of things.
Yeah. So that's the BassRock slab. And the basically, because of how we decided to do BassRock to make it as simple as possible, we wanted to make as Ubuntu does, we want to do the builds on the architecture themselves. So in order for us to really make a product for ARM, a BassRock product for ARM, we needed to go away and get hold of an ARM server. Now, we went around all the people who say, yeah, we've got ARM servers, yeah, we can sell them, and that they won't sell you an ARM server unless you're a very, very big company. So we built our own, put it together. It's available for sale now. Still ironing out a couple of hardware bugs here and there in the first run. But so we've designed that specifically for building software for embedded devices, but also having had some feedback from the market now, it's also people are quite excited about, you know, that the aspects of the design we made for our case are also seem to be applicable to some quite interesting cases that people are looking at using ARM servers for.
Right. So it looks to me like that's a very exciting device that is going to give, you know, it's got eight ARM cores, half U in height. Looks to me you can get a...
Actually, 32 ARM cores. There's
32.
Processes on there. 8 processors on there. Each one has 4 cores.
And each one has got some massive piece of storage. What did it say here? It says it's got a 30 gig solid-state disk for each core, or each CPU.
Basically, you see those fans? Underneath each of those fans is a processor with 4 cores, and underneath that is 30 gigs of storage.
So that sounds like I can get a whole cloud into one rack. I mean, if I've got, that's how many is that? I can get 72 of those in a rack, can't I?
Yes, and that's in theory. We get to test that out in practice, but in theory, yes, 72 of those, each one with 32 cores, or 8 running systems. So that's quite a lot of... And that's really where people are seeing interesting things with ARM, is that with ARM servers, the sheer amount of servers you can fit in a rack with it. It's actually the space density is actually one of the things that people are really interested in, we've found.
So are you actually going to make that a product? Is that the way you're going to monetize this open source work that you're doing on the build system?
So basically, think of it as that's a product which is, it's actually for sale now, and that's a product that's fallen out of our BassRock product. So as part of our BassRock product, we sell this server, but we also sell it separately if people want to use it and explore the ARM server world.
Right. So now, would I use your BassRock build system to put images onto that for a cloud application, or are you thinking that your BassRock embedded Linux build system is a kind of a different thing to this BassRock slab?
It's a really interesting question. I believe that the approach we've taken with the base shock embedded Linux system will apply in the server space. However, I think at this point it's a bit early to push that and see if that's the case. At the moment, people are still going, "Ooh, what can we use in our, you know, could we use an R server for this particular use case?" And they're looking at specific problems. So the question of what they run on it's still almost secondary at this point.
Right, right. Because, I mean, Red Hat are using something that looks a lot like Jenkins to push code out onto a cloud automatically within OpenShift. So I wondered whether your thinking around your BaseRock build system was along the same lines as what Red Hat are doing with OpenShift.
It's in some ways it's similar. In some ways it's similar.
Right, right. So, would you say that you think that you're going to turn into a hardware company? Or I've known CodeThink for a while now as an embedded consulting company, the sort of people you turn to get the hard bits done. Is that where you still think you're headed with as a software company, or do you think this hardware is going to be your future?
No, I think. You know, we've made this hardware in order to enable our BaseRock product and services around that product, and that's very much where we see our future at this point. So this is a product which we can sell to our customers and their partners to help make embedded systems an easier prospect across the board.
So just to geek out about the hardware a little bit more.
Sure.
And we'll get back to BaseRock, the software project, which is why you guys are here. But I mean, just to geek out about it a little bit, what kind of applications is it really targeted for? Is it really targeted for, because these are ARM processors, so it's quite different than multi-core, multi-processor, typical Intel architecture, let's say. It's a different architecture. So what kind of workload are you really targeting with this type of system?
Oh, well, for us, the workload is building. You know, we've designed it to build systems for build ARM systems.
So this would be the box that you would actually run the BaseRock software on and actually compile the code.
Absolutely.
And do your build there.
Actually.
So would it work equally well for any other build system? Or I'm trying to branch out here and think. You know, what else would it be applicable for?
I mean, I've got a. I think there's a white paper out on the website which has a bunch of possible use cases for this kind of hardware. I think having looked at the market engagement we've had from the hardware announcement, I'd say at this point you don't know. There's a lot of it's going to be used for people who have, at the moment, I think ARM is very much there for people who have specific cases where it makes sense. Right. I mean, you have to remember these are 32-bit processors.
Yep.
So that limits you on what you can run on them. But what you do have is a lot of network interconnectivity. I mean, inside one of those boxes, each of those processors has 5 gigabits to each of the to a central switch, which is inside the box, and 20 gigabits outside the box, and those boxes stack to form a single switching domain. So, you know, people who are looking at moving lots of data and processing it quickly, that's the sort of area that would make sense for this sort of product.
And it's less expensive, right? It's less expensive traditionally.
It depends on what you're using it for, really. For some cases, it will be less expensive. I mean, certainly for the case of building for ARM, it works out about a third of the cost of using Intel hardware for the same amount of processing power, mm-hmm. the same amount of throughput. But it really does depend on your use case what the most cost-effective route is.
Right.
I wouldn't say cost is the major factor. It's really novel novel uses where we see the interest.
Yeah, but I mean that's really what I mean. That's what enables this device. I've got my Pi right here. I mean that's what enables this device to be reasonable. In fact, I would say extremely inexpensive for people to purchase and work with. Right. So you know, granted, this is not the same system that you guys have developed by any means, right? Yeah. But you know, but the ARM architecture, I think, and I think even with the Raspberry Pi, that was a little bit of an issue at first because everybody had been using there had been some work on ARM, but it wasn't nearly as popular a system as like an x86 or a 64-bit system.
I'd love to see more of an ARM ecosystem for developers. You know, I've been working with ARM. Well, you know, I think I first used ARM when it was in a small British machine called the Acorn Archimedes back in the mid 90s. So I've got a lot of respect for that chip and the company itself. And you know, nowadays I could pretty much do everything I want on my Android phone, apart from do development. So, you know, I think there's some interesting space there, you know, once you start moving away from everything needs to be an Intel PC.
Yeah, and it's interesting now to see the swing back, right? So Intel is now working, you know, developing new chips to go into mobile because mobile is such a big area right now. And, of course, you know, I think ARM pretty much dominates that space, so it's interesting to see the switch back. You know, the swing back. It's like a pendulum is going more and more towards mobile devices, and so everyone's kind of following that. Let's go where the market is. So now let's get back to BaseRock itself. So, kind of walk me through. You laid it out pretty good earlier on, but kind of walk me through. As a developer or as someone working with embedded systems, I mean, what, especially when I'm going to beyond development into production, does BaseRock continue to help me, you know, push out new code? I mean, there's obviously once you get the hardware finalized, there are certain limitations to what you have in that particular piece of hardware. But there's always new software being developed, always new code that's going into the various drivers and things. So does BaseRock help from an ongoing standpoint as well beyond just the development cycle?
Lars, do you want to take that? I've been talking way too much.
That's what we have designed the system for. It's nice to have a system that is easy to build and very fast to build, but it's also crucial for embedded systems of today and of the future that they can be updated, that you can add a new kernel version to fix a security bug, for example.
Right.
Any system, any embedded system today is vulnerable to attacks. And if you can't have your operating system and the application software upgraded at will, quickly. As soon as there is a fix, then your car will get hijacked. Your pacemaker will be stopped by attackers, or your television will no longer work because the neighborhood bicycle gang decides it's fun to crash everyone's television. These kinds of things make it absolutely crucial that you can update your system. And we've designed BaseRock so that this becomes practicable. And not just in theory, but also that you can do it every day if you wish.
Yeah, because obviously, I mean, I'm thinking of devices that I've got at home, like my Blu-ray player, my Wii, all these devices that, you know, go out and look for an update and, you know, occasionally you'll get some sort of security thing that comes through or new software features. Like my Blu-ray player, for example, has Netflix built in. In order to update that, they need to get the Netflix code, bake it in just as we're talking about, right? I mean, as far as bake it into their build and then push that out so that when the device goes and looks at it, pulls down a new image and applies it. That's pretty much right, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And that's also something that we do with BaseRock. And there are basically two sides to this problem. One is the actual pushing out of updates and making sure that when the update is applied on your device, the device continues to work. And we have a solution there on based on a piece of code we've written and using the Linux ButterFS file system. The other side is developing the fix. So before it can be shipped to devices, you have to make sure that you make all the code changes, that you import all the changes to the kernel or the X-Window system or GStreamer or whatever component you need to update. And you so that you can do it so that it doesn't take you a long time, it doesn't take you a lot of effort, it doesn't make you grow gray the hair, as some people have done so far. I have a long experience with developing the Debian system. I've been a Debian developer since 1996. And when you have a system that has a very large number of components, like Debian has, everything tends to get difficult. If you want to change this component, that means that that other component also needs to be changed. Or you might need to change those three components at the same time. And while you're doing this, your coworker changes some other component that mysteriously breaks the things you're working on. And all of this means that the process with which you create new versions of your system needs to be managed in a way that makes sense. And we believe that with Bayshock, we have found a solution. We have created a solution that will work much better than anything else for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a question in the chat room, and I wanted to ask this as well. Just around ARM in general, like, is ARM going to become more, and it sounds like we're trending this way, but is ARM going to become more of a general purpose architecture like x86 or 64-bit? Is that, do you think that that's the trend, that's where the industry going? And then that leads to a second question, which is, how do you develop for both platforms if you're doing a software build that needs to support multiple architectures? Can you do that with Bayshock as well?
So yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think certainly the next ARM are already starting to make progress with their 64-bit ARM processor. And so what you see with it, what you end up with is not just a ubiquitous processor design. You know, if you look at Intel, basically everything's a Pentium 3, you know, various combined together in different ways. With ARM, you've got a kind of everything from like a tiny, tiny little processor that you'd put in the clock on a fridge or something, through to, you know, a processor you can run your server software on. I think that's pretty clear from ARM's roadmap that's where they'd like to be. In terms of how you develop both, this is a key problem. You know, it's kind of the problem that previously only embedded systems guys or the guys that deal with the more obscure end of server hardware, like, you know, like the IBM Z series or IBM Power, you know, who are, you're going to find a few Debian guys that know about that side of the story. And this is one of the things I found throughout the years, is actually the extremes of computer size, you know, that the embedded systems face a very similar set of problems to the guys who are doing massive iron. It's just they express the problem slightly differently. So you've got the problem, like, you know, I've got some software. Can I build it? Can I run it on an ARM processor? Can I build it? Can I run it on an Intel processor? And most people's build systems and software at the moment assume they're going to be running on an Intel processor. So you've got, first of all, buying something like a slab and using something like Bayshock to, you know, start building your software and testing whether it works is a sort of place you've got to start. You know, you've got to get some ARM hardware, start building on it and start finding the problems. And ideally working with partners who understand the kind of problems you're going to face, you know, you know, it depends on what your software is, how hard that's going to be. You know, if you've written a load of, you know, if your infrastructure is, you know, a load of Ruby, then you're probably going to be okay. You know, I know the Linara guys had to fix a few interesting bugs in Ruby around ARM recently, last year. But if you've got C, C++, you know, lower level compiled languages in there, then you start looking at a slightly more complex problem. So most big commercial software is going to have a bit of a, it's going to require quite a chunk of work to make sure that it is ready for running on ARM.
Yeah, it's not the same as using emulated systems, right? I mean. I've seen some people, you know, specifically like simple stuff like the Raspberry Pi, or most of the things that people are doing with Raspberry Pi are fairly simple. Using an emulated system to do their compiling.
You can use QMU, right. You know, quite you know, it's one of the old kind of old fashioned approach. You know, you get a Debian chroot for ARM, you run that inside of QMU, you type build, and then you go away and you have dinner and you go out and then go to sleep and you wake up in the morning and then you're ready to move on to the next step. Right. You know, this is the kind of you know, this is kind of one of the fundamental issues that we wanted to fix.
Yeah,
I'd also like to point out that writing software that works on multiple architecture, different kinds of systems, is both a new problem and an old problem.
Yes.
People who learned programming before the mid-90s dealt with anything from mainframes to mini computers to Commodore 64s and Amigas and so on. And they know that there are lots of different kinds of computers, so they write code that more carefully. They don't assume too much of the hardware, except in cases where it pays off to make architecture-specific code. And it's a new problem because the generations of programmers who grew up in the 90s and the noughts didn't have this. They had Intel and they had Windows. And they now need to learn that there is other things as well. Mm-hmm. Also, I'd like to point out that a lot of free software is very portable, mm-hmm. partly thanks to things like Debian and other distros that support multiple architectures. Debian supports something like 10 or 12. And we have fixed a ton of portability problems. And anything from assumptions on the size of the word to accessing memory in the wrong alignment and so on. These are not new problems. There are established ways of dealing with them. The easiest way of dealing with them is to make sure that when you build and develop your software, you do it on at least two different computers. If nothing else, you do it both on 32-bit Intel and 64-bit Intel. That already finds half your portability problems.
So, a fascinating question about all this work that you're doing here. What is the community dimension to all this? Is this all work that you're doing in-house at CodeThink, which you're just releasing into open source licenses and upstreaming to other communities? Or are you going to try and build a community around this Spacerock work yourselves?
I mean, it's still very early days. We certainly aim to build a community around the core of Spacerock. And really, one of the things that we think is core for Spacerock is that we can is engagement with the upstream projects themselves. One of the things we can, you know, if you using Spacerock, we can provide for upstreams is continuous testing, continuous integration of their work. And that's one of the things we quite like to do. But also, we're very interested in engaging, elite hacker community around Spacerock. You know, there's an IRC channel. We've got the Spacerock.org wiki there, and all the source of the major parts of Spacerock is open source and available. We have commercial add-ons to Spacerock, which we sell as part of our product. And also we will have a kind of a curated version of BassRock, which our customers are, which was available for purchase from our customers. But in terms of working on the bleeding edge on open source, that will be all be community driven. And we're, if anyone's interested in just even just chatting to us, please just come and join HashBassRock on Freenode. You'll find everyone's quite friendly.
And are there very many people over there at the moment? I mean, do you, you know, is there much of a community gathering around this, or is it all your work at the moment?
In terms of work, we're doing most of the work on this at the moment.
Right. I mean, I see quite a few names listed on the mailing list here. Are they all CodeThink people?
Pretty much, yeah.
Pretty much.
Right. Some people have been keeping me especially very busy. So we haven't had time for engaging the general public here. But we are now getting ready with the first versions of the actual commercial product. So things may pick up in speed now.
Yeah, hopefully we've got a bit more time now to spend on community development.
So, but I mean, I see a whole load of correspondence on the list here about development images and patches. Is it your goal to do all of your internal work on the mailing list like you would in an open source community so you can draw people in? Or is this just the tip of an iceberg?
We aim to have all the patches reviewed on the public mailing list, regardless of who's writing them.
Unless they're for our closed components.
Yeah.
Our added value components. So the development of our added value components is done on a separate mailing list using exactly the same processes. Obviously, we use our open source style processes all through the business, whether it's closed or open. But we make it so the open source components which go to BassRock are all the patches are reviewed publicly, all the discussions are had publicly.
Right. And I see you. So you're using Git. So you're pretty disconnected in process terms from the folk who are going to be working with you. Are you going to be using a contributor agreement to get copyright assignment back?
No. Our interest in terms of upstreams is to directly engage. I mean, at the end of the day, we're taking the world of open source, putting it in Git and making Git work and making Git work for people that want to build systems.
Right.
So there's not much space there for a contributor agreement.
Right.
Yeah, so it's mostly upstream code.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you're basically integrating a solution. I mean, you look a lot like what CodeBees what am I talking about here? About what the Jenkins folks have done in terms of integrating upstream code to make a running system. It looks very much like CloudBees.
I don't know CloudBees, but I'll certainly check it out after the.
You should go check them because they're the folk who are commercializing Jenkins to produce continuous integration in the cloud.
Oh, that's great. That's good to hear.
And I'd say that your product looks a lot like an embedded clone of CloudBees business.
Well, I don't know if it's a clone. I think there's some aspects of the business we won't be going into just yet, but let's have a look. I'll certainly take a look.
Right. So very interested to understand how you've selected the components that you're using here, because you had a bit of choice about the stuff. You know, why did you use Jenkins and not Hudson from Eclipse, for example?
I thought Jenkins was the free software version of Hudson.
It is, yes. I think that's it's a political question more than a software choice question. I think Lars's answer says it all. You know, that's where the community is.
Oh, that was what I was hoping you were going to say. So, I mean, is that what's guided your choice in the rest of the tools that you're using there? Or, what is the kind of thinking behind the way you've assembled this stack?
Yeah, we've assembled it in, we know what functionality we want to get to. We've gone out there and looked at which components make the most sense to help us get there quickly. And we've gone for the ones which have the most active developer communities. I mean, just like we would with any project that we'd be working on, building on open source.
Right, it's actually interesting. That's pretty much what City of Munich said about why they picked LibreOffice, was because they preferred to go with the active free software community. So, you know, going forward, do you have any other commercial organizations that are using BaseRock at the moment, or are you hoping that they're going to be joining in with you fairly soon?
I don't think I can go into that at this point, I'm afraid. Sorry. Well, good try, though.
So, to go off on a completely different tangent, I'm interested. I don't know whether you saw the news today that from the Raspberry Pi folks that they've persuaded Broadcom to open up the video core code and release it on the SD license. Do you have a reaction to that? I mean, I'm interested to know whether you think we're actually going to see ARM be a true host for fully open source systems anytime.
Well, unfortunately, if you go look at that code, it's basically GL function implementation, send a message, and each one is basically, for each function, it's send a message to the GPU to do that function. So in terms of actually, you know, say you wanted to add Wayland support to it, it's probably not going to help you an awful lot. It's basically, what they've done is just move all the closed sourceness to somewhere that's even harder to get to.
Right. Well, I was kind of getting...
It's still all closed source code. Most of the driver is closed source code running in the firmware of the GPU.
So I was beginning to get that impression from looking at all the comments on Slashdot, I have to say. But Eben's done a reasonable job there in opening up some of the code that's in the relation to Broadcom. You know, he's had a spec sheet published for one of the chips for the first time in history.
Yeah, and
we at least have the API shim to that closed source video code released. So, you know, it's slow but steady progress.
I mean, the video world is... really, really difficult. I mean, obviously, Kothik did some work around the open source work around the Mali chip, and you know, it's a very difficult area out there for companies that do want to open source their code. It's just a too litigious an area, and that's really holds people back, I think.
But, I mean, if we get enough information, it can be done, right? I mean, there are open source drivers for NVIDIA cards, for example, and then they may not give you all the functionality that you would have with the proprietary drivers. But
it's all reverse engineering.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, no one's going to release their information, but individuals out there working hard can reverse engineer the chips and make something that works. The chances of that them being supported by the silicon vendor at this point, I think, is pretty slim.
Right. So I want to, and I might get myself into trouble here, but I'm willing to open up myself to it. ButterFS or BetterFS, however you want to say it. You know, you say that you use that specifically. I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are on. You know, why did you pick that, and do you have plans to develop, you know, make it possible outside? I mean, I think I know why you did it, but it's good to explain it because it has some pretty cool features that allow you to do what it is you're trying to do, right?
Right. So the reason we wanted ButterFS is that when we have BaseRock running on a device and we do an upgrade of the operating system, we want to have a fallback. So if the upgraded version fails for some reason, something went wrong, and the user of the device doesn't want it to be dead, bricked, then we want BaseRock to automatically go back to the previous working version. And for this, we need to... The traditional approach would be to have two copies of the operating system. The old one that works and the new one. And this is good, except it space uses a lot of extra space. Basically, you need to double your the size of your flash memory.
Right.
Which can be a bit expensive. So instead, we decided to go with ButterFS, which is a copy and write file system. And you can have sub-volumes within the same disk, where one sub-volume is the old working system, and the other sub-volume is the new upgraded system, such that any files that they share that haven't been modified, or any blocks within files that haven't been modified, are only stored on the disk once. And the file system makes sure that you don't get any mixed blocks or mixed files. And this means that it's very cheap to do an upgrade, especially if you have a small incremental upgrade and you only small parts of your system have changed. And you can have not just two versions of your system on the device, you can have 50 versions or 100 versions, 250 versions. And this is especially useful for development. And it also makes things like upgrades go much faster.
Right. Now, did you consider any other file systems? Or is there another file system for ARM that would do what you needed it to do? Or
In terms of the features you need in the file system for the sort of thing that we're looking for, needs to have sub-volume support. Basically, you can be able to branch a file system, and your choices are BTRFS or ZFS.
Yeah.
ZFS isn't really at this point. You know, it's never going to be in the kernel at this point. So. That's pretty much it, really.
Yeah.
the main problem we have with BTRFS is currently, you know, if you're using it, you'd have to use it on what we call an eMMC storage, or a SATA disk inside the embedded device. And we'd like later on to be able to support running on top of raw NAND, but that's a little bit down the line.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, thanks. I just wanted to come back to that. I'm a storage guy, so I need to get those storage questions in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we should say, I mean, it's interesting some of your responses, because you guys aren't slouches when it comes to doing work, especially in the Linux environment, right? In fact, I think if I read correctly, Lars, you even contributed to one of the first, if not the first, patch to Linux shortly after it was released. Is that true?
That is true. Actually, it was about 6 months before it was released.
And was it the first patch, or can you claim that prize as having worked on the very first patch?
So the backstory there is that I went to university with Linus Torvalds, and we became friends. And while he was starting off with Linux development, I chatted often with him about all sorts of things about kernel and operating system development. We were both learning this stuff back then. And at some point, he had written a few things. He had a very basic operating system kernel, and he needed logging. He wanted to be able to put print statements in his code in order to figure out what the code was actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution he had written or was writing was to have a different C function for every type of value he needs to write out. So he had one for strings, one for integers, one for floating point values, and so on. And this becomes really tedious to write in the code. So if you have want to write out a message that consists of a few words, a number, some more words, another number, and so on, you have one line in the code for each of these bits of the message. And that's when I stepped in and said that you're doing this entirely wrong. there is a standard C library function called printf that everyone is normally using. It doesn't actually work in the kernel because the kernel cannot use any of the C standard library. However, I wrote a version of the inner core of the printf function for him. And it's still in the kernel. It's now known as snprintf. Back then, it was sprintf. So they have added an N since then. And Linus took
very
my
important.
Code.
That's a very important N.
Yes. Linus looked at my code and learned a couple of things of writing code in C. He was still learning C at that point. And then he rewrote parts of the code, and there's a famous comment at the top of that file saying that I wrote it portably and Linus f***ed it up.
What an awesome story. I love that. Well, guys, listen, we have come to the end here. I've got one last question from the and I don't know if you guys have if maybe this is published on your site, but it's just in terms of the cost of the slab product. Is that something that's published? Can you talk about that?
I think at this point it's best to contact via the site and get a price application.
Okay. So if you're interested in the Base Rock slab, get in contact with you guys. Otherwise, how do people get involved? Should they just go to baserock.org or?
Yeah, certainly. So in terms of if you're looking at Base Rock for a commercial point of view, come and talk to our sales team, and you can get contact there from the Base Rock website, baserock.com. If you're interested in getting involved as a community member, you can read a lot of stuff on baserock.org, and you can join in the mailing list there and join us on IRC on Freenode on #baserock.
Okay, and if I just want to use BaseRock at this point, is it, can I actually go out and download the source or assuming I have some sort of a suitable platform to run it on?
We publish on the BaseRock.org site a couple of system images for the Intel platform at the moment, and a couple of versions of those. So one is a base system and one is a system meant for development. You can run these on a virtualization system like KVM or VirtualBox, and there are instructions for that on the website. And all the code that goes into those is available on git.baserock.org. We build everything from that Git server.
Okay. Great. And one other question too. I hate to stop, but
good to hear.
Yeah, you mentioned that you could run it on a VirtualBox server, I think is what I just heard. So, I mean, could I actually do anything with the Pi then? If I'm running that or not really?
At this point we're not quite ready for that, I think. I mean, I guess if you're really interested in getting your hands dirty, you could start trying to build up a server out of ARM components and start trying using BaseRock on ARM. Mm-hmm. Down the line, we have an idea to have a kind of simple GitHub like service which allows you to use BaseRock for ARM devices without having to go and buy a BaseRock slab yourself.
Right.
But at the moment, it's pretty much, building for ARM is still something, it's the ARM server side that's the hard bit.
Yeah.
So, it's going to cost money at this point or a lot, getting, rolling your sleeves up and getting your hands dirty.
Right. Okay, great. I think that's going to bring us to an end, guys. Really appreciate you guys joining. Very interesting project, and cool. I hope that everybody goes and checks it out. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam.
All right.
Thanks, Simon.
All right, so that was BaseRock, a little bit of hardware, a little bit of software, kind of covered all the bases. Simon, what do you think about BaseRock based on what you heard today?
It's a very interesting start. Those BaseRock slabs are very exciting because they mean that you can put into a single rack something that's got enormous computing power. So I find those very interesting. The overall continuous integration for embedded system, I looked very young to me. It's very promising. Looking at what CloudBees have done with their continuous integration for business software stack, you can see that it's a great idea. But I think they're going to have to get some more players on board before it gets critical mass and becomes really interesting.
Hmm. Yeah. I thought it was it's also interesting to me to get the whole the question about ARM in general, where is ARM going as a as a technology? Will it become more general purpose? I mean, I think that that's really interesting, especially as people use more and more ARM devices. They actually are thinking, hey, maybe this is the way to go. I know that even, I believe Raspberry Pi and some others have said, look, we're going to develop these boards that could potentially be slotted into kind of a blade architecture for processing on, you know, in more of a general purpose way. So,
well, you know, we've seen this week that there, you know, you can see here, I've got my Chromebook.
Yep.
There's ARM chips inside the Chromebook now. They're gradually moving into a place where we're seeing them on the desktop. Think of that. You know, the probably the most viable Linux desktop on the market at the moment is running on ARM and not Intel.
Mm-hmm.
So ARM has obviously got an interesting future ahead of it. And I think these guys are right to be targeting ARM. It's definitely what's being used in mobile and in automotive. So exactly the right place to be touching, I think. But they need to get a bit more mass around them. And it was interesting to hear that Rob and Lars are going to be focusing more on community development soon.
Yeah, and that's great. That's great. That's what we like to hear. Okay, so let's talk about real quick about upcoming shows. Randall will be back in a couple of weeks. Next week, however, we have Image Factory coming on the show. And Image Factory enables appliance creation and deployment to multiple virtualization and cloud providers. So we're going back to cloud. Seems to come up almost in every show, and we've got a lot of people playing in this space. And so this is one of the projects that we want to get on for next week, and that'll probably be Dan and myself. I'll come back and co-host that with Dan. On November 7th, Randall should be back, and we're going to talk about something called Air Chatbox. It's really a scripting service that allows you to interactively from, I believe, an IRC chat room, actually, put out things like random humor, notes about starting a build, things like that that can actually help you if you happen to be using an IRC system. So that should be actually quite interesting. Then on November 14th, we'll have something called Poodle, not the dog Poodle, but Poodle with a T, which is a user-friendly web portal that makes the translation process simpler. It allows online translation, work assignment, gives statistics, and allows easy volunteer contribution. So we're going to talk about that system, Poodle. And then similarly, the next week on November 21st, we're going to be talking about Zenata, which is also web-based translation management, but it's I think it's more geared towards actually doing this for a given software project. So if you have a software project, it has both code and documentation, and it's supposed to be kind of an automated way, or at least semi-automated way, to translate into various systems or open it up to translators to come and work on it. So it's supposed to make all that a lot easier, and that's sponsored by Red Hat. So we'll be talking about that on November 21st. Real quickly here, if you want to follow us on Google+, I would recommend adding us to your circles on Google+. You can also follow at Floss Weekly on Twitter and Identica. Of course, you can chat with us live as we do the show on irc.twit.tv and watch live at the same time on live.twit.tv. So make sure that you follow us and watch us regularly. Let me kick it back over to Simon. Anything you want to plug or bring up before we wrap it up?
Well, naturally. So I encourage everyone who's viewing to go visit my website, webmink.com, where you'll find links to all the things that I'm doing, in particular my weekly column on InfoWorld. In the next month, I'll be speaking at a number of events. Let's look down at my calendar down here. I'm going up to Birmingham on November 6th to speak at a thing called Skunkworks, which is to do with the UK health industry and open source. Then I'm going on to the USA, and I'll be in San Francisco from the 8th to the 12th of November. If your local group would like me to come and speak or attend, then please get in touch through the website. Then the 16th of November, I'll be in Bolzano in Italy speaking at SFSCon, which is one of the most enjoyable little bijou open source events. Then at the end of November, I'll be in Malaysia speaking at the Malaysian government's open source conference. I'd love to see you at any of those events. And if you'd like me to come and speak at your local group in conjunction with any of those, then do please get in touch. Otherwise, look for me on Twitter and on Identica as Webmink, and on Google+, you'll need probably to go to one of my InfoWorld articles on my website to find the link to my profile, because Google still doesn't let ordinary mortals like me have easy URLs for things.
Me either. But you definitely should add Simon to your circles on Google+. He's in my circles, and it's such a great pleasure to have you here, Simon. You bring such a great wealth of knowledge about the open source community and history of open source projects. So I always feel privileged to be able to host or co-host with you, and it's been a while, so it's nice to see you again.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Aaron, and your fee is in the post.
Well, while you're out here, I might try to hook up with you and have a drink or something, or at least say hi. You can also follow me on Google Plus or any of the networks. I'm Aaron Newcomb on all of them, but I prefer Google Plus because I can have interesting discussions, a little bit more engagement there, and that's what I'm really after. I don't care whether you follow me or not, but I'd like to talk to you, so follow me on Google Plus. All right, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of Floss Weekly. Thanks for watching.